And we are, as a people, inherently and historically
wake up.
Opposed to secret societies, the secret oaths, and the secret proceedings.
The show that asks questions about why we don't ask questions.
What the hell is going on?
This is Conspiracy Queries with Alan Park. Welcome to Conspiracy Queries with Alan Park. These are the Conspiracy Queries, and I am the Alan Park. And I've already used two superfluous words in my own introduction. If you'd like to win a contest as to which superfluous words I use, send in the entry form to the radio station. Oh, I'm sorry. I've given them away. It was actually the, and I said it twice. Well, I'm feeling a bit silly today because I guess it's global warming or whatever people are saying is global warming. I don't know. But it's a nice day. And it, by all rights, should be horrible outside where we sit in Canada waiting for the winter with bated breath, which I realized recently does not mean your mouth smells like a bucket full of worms. It's not what that means. Bated breath. It's a different spelling. Look it up. We have a great guest on the show today. But, you know, I could say that at any time because all of the guests on the show so far have been great. And I'm telling you, the listener, that. And I'm also telling the guests that so that they'll come back on. Hello? Phone's not ringing. Just curious why that is. No, actually, we do have a lot of people coming back on the show soon-ish into the new year. And those people have very fascinating things to say. But there are also other people out there, and there are other topics that in this calendar year of 2013 I wasn't able to get to because there's only one show a week, although we're trying to get two happening. So today our guest, before we bring him on, I should tell you a little bit about him in case you don't know who he is. And if you don't know who he is, I don't know why you're listening to this particular program. But maybe you don't know who he is, and we'll tell you. Our guest today is a doctor. His name is Dr. Stephen Greer, and he used to be an emergency room doctor, which is kind of stressful, I would imagine. That's where he realized that there must be more to life on this planet than being an emergency room doctor. And so overnight, he opened CSETI, or the Center for the Study of Extraterrestrial Intelligence. Yeah, not really overnight. I don't think the chain of events was that short. There was probably a bridge loan or two in there to get CSETI organized. But yeah, that's pretty out there and ballsy and fascinating. The Center for the Study of Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And eventually they managed to gather enough data, which led to the Disclosure Project. The Disclosure Project meaning, well, it's an attempt by many researchers, including Dr. Greer and many others, such as Rich Dolan, who we've had on the show, and other experts and witnesses to come forward and force the government's hand at exposing the real facts behind the alien presence on Earth and in our solar system and in our lives. So that's who Stephen Greer is, a major monumental force in that field. We'll be talking about his research into that field, his movie that came out about a year ago called Sirius, which is fascinating. But before we get into that, more bad news if you like this planet. And that's the only one I'm living on at the moment that I know of. So anytime stuff like this happens, it bothers me. fracking is kind of destroying the planet so that you can have a little bit more natural gas, which I then assume you power things that help further damage the planet, I guess. But there's a bit of a standoff going on. While it may be nice here in the Toronto, Southern Ontario part of the Canadian world, it's a little more snowy and wintry in New Brunswick as the anti-fracking protesters fight for, quote, the next seven generations. And this is from rinf.com. RINF for all your crazy news needs. And I mean that in a good way. A snowy standoff took place in New Brunswick between Canada's Royal Canadian Mounted Police. That's the gang that wears red jackets, sort of like the Canadian Bloods. And the anti-fracking protesters recently, as Elsa Pogtog community members and their allies continue to fight to protect their land from shale gas exploration, which a lot of people say causes earthquakes. Texas had like 13 earthquakes in the last couple of weeks. Not usually the case for Texas. Back to this story. Twitter users captured a lineup of protectors facing police along Highway 11, where energy company SWN Resources has trucks conducting seismic testing for shale gas. Basically, the Canadian government is putting a lot of money into making sure something that's not healthy and worthwhile goes through. I'm sure most of us won't enjoy that. But it means jobs, 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 so it must be great. Unless you remember that continual growth is also one of the characteristics of cancer. A similar protest on Highway 11 on Friday, I guess that was the previous Friday, blocked the road for hours, and several protesters were arrested for breaching a court injunction by SWN, the crooked, horrible, nasty corporation at the bottom of this. Fracking. They don't care. They just want the money, them and their board. Under terms of the court order, protesters cannot interfere with the company's shale gas exploration. They must stay 20 meters away from the side of roads where the company is working and 250 meters away from the front or back of its trucks. If you're listening in the States, a meter is a yard or pretty close to it. And really, let's get on the metric system here. In the States, like the only country that doesn't do that. Next thing you know, you're going to freeze out any kind of diplomatic relations with Cuba for the next 50. Sorry, that's already happening. The Friday arrests brought to total 14 arrests in 1 week. They have tear gas. They have guns. We have nothing, said protester Mary O'Kay. That's her name, Mary O'Kay. They're the ones that are blocking the road right now. Some people accused the officers of acting like private security for the company. Well, that wouldn't be a first time that the cops that we pay for with taxes would act like a private security firm for those with the deep pockets. You just have to go back to Occupy to remember the depth of that depravity. Why is it depravity? And then if you're depraved, you're depraved. But it's depravity. They've really thrown us a loop with that English. The fight represents a global issue, protesters say, and are calling for solidarity. And for Monday, a couple days ago, to be a day of emergency action. We are not giving up despite these harsh weather conditions, sacrificing time with our families, our jobs, our homes, not only to protect land, water, and people, but to ensure a brighter future for the next seven generations. Doesn't say here where they're. Give a rat's about the eighth generation, but yeah, probably won't make it that far anyway. We are asking for more support through roadblocks to be in solidarity. This is not just an Elsa Pogtog issue. That's the name of the native band, by the way. This is a global issue, and we need to raise awareness. Show us your support in any way possible by sending thank yous, roadblocks, banners, even dropping by. All and every type of support is appreciated. That's what's going on. Or as we have private companies trying to frack into, an earthquake kind of scenario, while our publicly funded police protect the privately funded interests. That if they find this stuff, will charge you an unbelievably unfair premium for said use of gas. There used to be a company called Consumers Gas. Never mind. We're going to move on. Anyway, that's how horrible that is. And just to let you know what the police are doing, And some of the, this is on APTN News, the Aboriginal People's Television Network news, that they were round dancing and burning tires as they refused surrender. That was as of today, actually. So they must have done all right on Monday. Round dancing. Late Monday evening, after the tires were set afire, a group of anti-fracking demonstrators round danced against a backdrop of flames in the middle of a New Brunswick highway while they waited for the RCMP to respond. The tires were set alight in the late afternoon around the same time a New Brunswick court judge in the provincial capital of Fredericton granted an extension to an injunction against the demonstrators for 14 more days. So it's a waiting game, unfortunately. And all the time this is happening, we're getting news from the west coast of the country that if we're not going to have the pipeline that critics of Obama want to have and connect up the, as Neil Young would say, Hiroshima-like Western Canada, Alberta, Athabasca, tar sands to the United States, that they're just going to ship it across in trains, which apparently blow up every once in a while and burn the towns that they are snaking through in the middle of the night, all with no repercussions to the company. We just need to think of new things. And this is one of the things we will be discussing with Dr. Greer. As much as it may sound like an alien show, and it will be, as much as it discusses other planets, it also raises the very fascinating concept of, if these aliens are getting here, how are they doing that? Not with a liter or a gallon of gas from the local gas station, that's for sure. But before we get to that part of the show, Let's take a quick step away here. You're listening to Conspiracy Queries on Sirius XM Canada Talks, Channel 167. And we're back, and we are ready to go to our interview. With us today, Dr. Stephen Greer of the CSETI and the Disclosure Project, and a longtime now pioneer in the field of extraterrestrials, suppressed technology. Those are linked. We'll get to that. And also governmental conspiracies. This all ties in, unfortunately, to, let's say, the suppression and ignoring of a lot of Dr. Greer's fine work. Dr. Greer, thank you for coming on. I wonder if you could tell us just a little bit to get started for those who may not know you and what you've been up to these last 20 years, how you got started on this path.
Yes, well, I'm an ER doctor, emergency medicine medical doctor, who got involved with this is really because I had a sighting of what the public call UFOs back when I was quite young and began to study the issue. And I have a family member, my uncle, who worked on the lunar module, actually was with Grumman, which is now Northrop Grumman, that designed the lunar module, put the first man on the moon. For people who don't remember, it was a funny-looking thing that landed on the moon in 1969. So I have an aerospace family background, and then I'd had a very close encounter and sighting and started digging into it. And I really discovered that not only was the subject real, but the reason that it's ridiculed and poo-pooed and sort of dismissed is because there's been a very deliberate attempt to obfuscate and hide the truth on it, because really what's behind the secrecy is that since the 1950s, we have not needed oil, gas, or coal, or for that matter, surface highways between cities, that those technologies have been studied and developed for over 60 years. And I think that that's the part that shocks people. I know that when I, some years ago in the 1990s, I briefed President Clinton's team and his CIA director personally on this matter. I think the very first question out of the CIA director's mouth wasn't, are UFOs real? Because he and his wife had had a sighting years ago in New Hampshire. He said, why are they keeping this from me and the president? And I was stunned to hear that they were. And I said, well, I think it's because the technologies behind how these things that people see and videotape and photograph are moving, it ain't using exogeny fuel. It's not using a conventional physics, and it's not using a fossil fuel or a nuclear power plant. So you're talking about an area of physics and science that's really at the core of the secrecy. When I discovered that that was the issue, I dedicated to starting something called the Disclosure Project. And people who want to see the kind of evidence we've accumulated can go to SiriusDisclosure.com. That's like Sirius XM, SIRIUS, Disclosure.com. And you'll see that we have dozens of top secret military and CIA and Defense Intelligence Agency witnesses' testimony up there on videotape and government documents and just a huge amount of proof that this is going on. I think that most people had not figured out, and certainly the people at the senior ranks of the political system in the government, as opposed to the sort of deep national security state, which we can get to in a minute. But the people at the top of the government that everyone thinks, oh, well, the president knows what's going on, the CIA director is going on, they don't know anything. And I can say that with some authority because I briefed people like that for now over 20 years. In fact, it was December 13th, 1993, 20 years ago, when I briefed the CIA director for the first time on this issue. And what I've discovered is something that people think, well, the government's keeping this secret. I said, well, which government? So there's sort of a paragovernmental deep national security state that's keeping this stuff secret, not the conventional folks that, we send to Washington every 2 or 4 years.
Okay. You were saying that the disclosure in the movie, the Sirius movie that you have, and we'll get into that later on for folks. Sirius, as you said, like the radio station,
right?
The radio organization,
right?
James Woolsey at the time, he was the CIA director when you spoke with him, and he said he didn't understand why himself and the president were unaware of these.
Right. He was what's called the DCI, the Director of Central Intelligence, which the common parlance would be the CIA director. And a friend of his who was on my team set up a meeting because the CIA director and the president had made inquiries into the UFO issue and basically had been denied access or had been told lies about it. In fact, Webster Hubble, who was the third highest ranking guy at the Justice Department for President Clinton, wrote a book called Friends in High Places, where he states that the president asked him to look into two things: who killed Jack Kennedy and what's going on with UFOs. And in the book, Webster Hubble admits, and we later spoke to Webster Hubble about this, that basically they weren't happy with the answers they were getting and knew they were being lied to. So there's this sort of misunderstanding in the public that they think, oh, well, President Obama or President Clinton or W or whoever really knows what's going on in this vast national security state and apparatus that's out there, and they know some of the stuff going on. I'm not saying they don't know anything. The Presidential Daily Briefing, the PDB, has some information, but it's really there are deep black, if you want to call them that, or unacknowledged projects. And those projects really are outside the reach, unfortunately, of a lot of these people that the common person on the street would just be shocked to find out that how broken our system is.
Well, to go on and add to that is in the movie that in your Sirius movie, it's mentioned in there that later on, James Woolsey denies having that conversation with you, certainly to that depth, and merely begs off by saying, oh, I met Dr. Greer. We had a dinner with some other people, and anything that he said on this level has been taken out of context. So I think James Woolsey did find out or was told by someone, please back away from the trough.
Oh, he did back away and was offered a plum position as chief counsel at Booz Allen Hamilton, which has all been in the news for the Snowden affair. They're the ones who do all the contracting for the National Security Agency and a whole bunch of other secret government programs. And so he took a golden parachute after being CIA director into that world. And so who knows what happened? I haven't really been in touch with him since then. I have very good friends of mine who've been in touch with him. Luckily, I saved the letter from the CIA director, Woolsey's friend, who set up the meeting when it explicitly says that the meeting is to do this in-depth briefing because the CIA director has not been given access. I have this letter in my archive. So unfortunately, when Woolsey and his henchmen tried to deny this, it was like they were caught flat-footed in another cover-up. But, of course, I mean, that, you know, one of the things I say about these folks in Washington, I know it's rather cynical to say this, but, you know, how do you know they're lying? Their lips are moving.
Yeah. Well, you're preaching to the choir there. I mean,
it's just ridiculous.
With that in mind, how do you, you're just so prominent in the field. I guess that's how you managed to get involved and get yourself down to Washington, as you did earlier this year, for the citizens' hearings that you were late April, early May this year, and you gave much testimony to former members of the government, and it's a very government-friendly operation, but you decry them at so many levels, and that's not a criticism. I'm in full agreement with you there as far as the suppression is concerned, which then becomes conspiratorial. How do you get yourself? How are they okay with you going into Washington and shaking it up for a few days?
Well, they're not okay, but I mean, I've had a lot of problems, a lot of harassment, a lot of stalkers and hacking into our systems and all kinds of stuff over the years. But the thing is that I'm persistent. And ultimately, I don't talk about anything that I can't prove and that I don't have what they would call actionable intelligence on, whether it's a deep source that's a whistleblower or a document or some proof of it. So when we say that we know for a fact that we have been working on these technologies. And one of the highest-ranking scientists at the Naval Research Labs, NRL, which is the biggest Department of Defense lab in the world for the United States, that's there in southwest Washington across from National Airport, is someone I've known for many, many years, maybe 15 years or longer. And he told me that he was in what they call the vault, quote-unquote, where a lot of documents dealing with this and other issues are kept. And he saw a document where basically it stated that in October of 1954, now that's almost 60 years ago, is when they mastered what's called gravity control through these electromagnetogravitic systems, these electronic systems that control for things that would look like they levitate and move the way many people see these UFOs moving. So what I tell people is that UFO means two things. It can be an extraterrestrial vehicle, and they do exist, or it can be a man-made anti-gravity vehicle. And that's actually more secret than the ET stuff. Why? Because they don't want to admit that our tax dollars have been working on technologies that, if they were disclosed, would completely bring us out of the coal, oil, fossil fuel, nuclear power world. You know, I point out to people that everything we're using is basically from the 1800s, with the exception of nuclear power plants, which were generating electricity by splitting the atom. But all that's doing is creating heat to turn a turbine generator or steam engine, like in the 1800s, coal-fired power plants, 1800s, the internal combustion engine from cars, 1800s. So now let's look at aircraft. You know, 1908 were, propeller planes with the Wright brothers there in North Carolina on the Outer Banks, the Kitty Hawk. But jets were the 30s, and rockets were Wernher von Braun from early 1940s. So are we really, do people really believe that there have been no advances in the physics of propulsion and energy generation since the early to mid-1940s? So I tell people there's almost a century of missing technology that is the heart of the secrecy. And the reason for it is the multi-trillion dollar, petrodollar, and oil and macroeconomic powers, more than you can imagine, who absolutely do not want this information out.
And is that because you just cannot seem to profit from what this next wave, this next field of propulsion and for lack of a better word, fuel is?
Well, you could profit from the initial device, but the supply line of fuel is non-existent. In other words, you're pulling energy out of what's called the zero-point energy field. And, one of the senior writers for Jane's Defense Weekly, that's J-A-N-E-S, it's a very prestigious defense journal, mm-hmm. out of Britain called Jane's Defense Weekly, who we briefed, ended up doing an expose on this and then wrote a book called The Hunt for Zero Point. and Nick Cook is his last, C-O-O-K is his last name. And basically, you know, he discovered the same thing I'm telling you now, that this stuff has been in classified projects for a very, very long time at places like my uncle's old company, Northrop Grumman, and Lockheed Martin, and the Boeing Phantom Works, which used to be McDonnell Douglas Phantom Works. These entities have this sort of technology. And but when you look at where is the, what is the zero point energy field? Well, it's basically the energy that's in the space around, not outer space, but the space around us. And once you set up an electronic system that pulls energy out of that field, you're not having to pay to burn oil or coal or split an atom or do any of that. So it's essentially, quote unquote, free energy. It's environmentally free energy, the way sunlight is free, but much more powerful. And so then you get to this question, okay, let's take your average Chevy Suburban. Well, the engine in that thing's worth maybe $5,000, but over the life of the car running on the road, it's going to use $40,000 or $50,000 in gasoline. That's where the money is. The money isn't in the engine. It's in the supply line. Same thing with your heat pump. Your heat pump cost you a couple thousand dollars. But over the life of that heat pump, it's going to use tens of thousands of dollars in electricity. So that's where the money is. And that you have to do a macroeconomic analysis to understand what's behind the secrecy. And this is one of the things that I began to teach and share with the Honorable Paul Hellyer, who is the former Minister of Defense for Canada, who stumbled across this issue, and who he and I did a press conference up in Toronto a few years back, and when he looked into it, he says, well, then that makes complete sense, because you're really talking about really changing the way we would live on this planet. Now, of course, there'd be no pollution. Probably in a generation, there'd be no poverty in the world, but the kleptocracy of petrofascists that kind of run the world and run the banking system and the petrodollar system, they're going to have to find something else to do with the, and they're going to lose the centralized power they have. So in a sense, it's really not about money. It's the power behind the money, or is that the root of it? And I think this is what most people don't understand, that the whole UFO and ET issue gets trivialized into sort of the silly season of stuff. I briefed personally for a very long time the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, which is kind of like the CIA inside the Pentagon, and General Patrick Hughes, who's a three-star general, asked me to come in and do a very extensive briefing for him, and he was mortified because he knew he's sending his young guys out on the battlefield in Iraq and Afghanistan with, you know, being blown to pieces and limbs being blown off. And that so much of our activities in the world have to do with what's called our national security interests in the Middle East. Well, that translates to oil, doesn't it? Because, I mean, Israel has 300 or 400 nuclear bombs. They can defend themselves. So it really comes down to this energy sector. And so we have a multi-trillion-dollar operations in those wars and all these interests. And, of course, we're hated for being over there. But at the root of it is this ugly three-letter word, oil. And that's what people don't seem to get. And so the secrecy behind UFOs is directly related to that. And that's what we've been exposing. And people want to really see the evidence for it. They can go to seriousdisclosure.com, and there's just hundreds and hundreds of pages of materials.
And in that regard, is that part of the – are we discussing exopolitics here? Or can you put a finer point on that?
Well, you know, that's a term that some people use. I tell people there's another dimension of this, and the other dimension of it is sort of the fantasy world of the whole ET question, where people say, oh my God, there are aliens invading us and doing stuff. When you pull the curtain back on the Wizard of Oz behind all that, you find out that, yes, there are ET events that have happened, and there have been people who have had and made contact periodically. I head up a diplomatic team that works on this. But a lot of the information in that area gets into what I call crafted disinformation that's designed to create kind of fear in the public. Because, what you know, Wernher von Braun, for those of you who don't remember, was the guy who invented the rocket for Adolf Hitler. His spokeswoman for the last few years of his life is on our team, and she said, oh yeah, all he talked about for the last few years of his life was that they were going to eventually not only go from the Cold War to global terrorism, but then move from global terrorism to a threat from outer space. And it's all a hoax. there is no threat from outer space. But they would like people to think there is, because that's the next big thing in military and defense spending, is to put things in space and say, oh, we have to protect against something out there.
Reagan trotted that old canard out, as I recall.
Yeah, and I would say 90% of the UFO research community has been taken in by that nonsense. So, you know, what I say to people is that it's kind of like the peace movement or the environmental movement. They did a FOIA thing and found out that if you were at an anti-war gathering in New York City in the 60s or 70s, there'd be 18 people there, and 15 of them were on the payroll of the intelligence community, but they looked like hippies and were smoking pot. So what you find in this subject is that there's a lot of false information that's pervade out there that sounds scary as hell, but it really just has to do with how do you create a new enemy. Because, you know, Leon Panetta, who I put a briefing together for him when he was CIA director for Obama, he basically admitted that we're spending $110 billion a year in Afghanistan to chase down 70 Al-Qaeda. 70, count them, 70. And not 7 million or 7,000, 70. So, you know, if you're going to be spending $1 trillion a year on Homeland Security, military, CIA, DIA, all these alphabet, NSA, you're going to have an enemy. And if you can't, you know, create one, you've got to, you know, you got to start creating the next one. And the next one, in my opinion, that Wernher von Braun was on the inside and warned of this on his deathbed, is this sort of threat from outer space, which is just rubbish.
When you look at those threats from outer space,
right.
And you say that, you said earlier and casually, and I loved it, was that aliens do exist.
They do.
They obviously are, and we'll get into why you know that in the next segment. But it'll be very interesting, I'm sure. But are you saying that these aliens, obviously they are coming here with whatever means of propulsion or warp drive or maybe time travel? I have no idea. But they do come here and they are observing us at a certain level. Would you say that's accurate?
Well, I think they're coming here clearly out of several things. One, you know, there's one of the witness testimonies we just put up was an old Gordon Crichton, who was an old British intelligence guy, and he said, "Look, when we've started detonating nuclear weapons, atomic weapons in the 40s, basically it stirred up a hornet's nest where there were civilizations that have been observing this planet for a very long time." And once we went from, you know, blowing each other up with muskets and cannons and machine guns to weapons that could destroy the entire planet, and if put off out in space could destroy other planets, we became viewed as an existential threat to ourselves and possibly others. And I think that's when the modern era of UFO sightings began. If you look at the 40s, 50s, 60s, that's when there were so many things being seen, and our Air Force was encountering them, and there was all these reports in the media before the media stopped reporting on this issue because of their own collusion with the intelligence community. But I think that if you look at the trajectory, it clearly had to be that someone out there, they're not hostile to us, because, you know, when I tell people, you know, I was at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base where the remains from the Roswell crash were sent, and that event did happen, by the way. And I was meeting with the colonel in charge of the Foreign Technology Division that then became the Foreign Aerospace Science and Technology Center, and this colonel, Canola was his name, he looked at me, he said, "Well, what if these visitors are a threat?" I said, "Sir, with all due respect, given all the stupid things we've been doing, if they were a threat, it would have been point, set, match, and it would have all been over by 1945,
yeah,
and made it the first atomic bomb." I said, "The fact is that we're still breathing the free air of Earth shows how possibly enlightened, but certainly restrained they are. Because if you have the ability to go from one star system to another, if you saw that, if you want to take care of, shall we say, the problem here on this planet, it would just be over." So I don't see that they have that mindset. I think they have two concerns. One is the possibility of us becoming a threat. The second is the possibility we could destroy the entire biosphere and also engage in these nuclear weapons, destroying the planet as a habitable place. But also, I think they're hopeful, as I am. The reason I'm now doing this instead of medicine, I'm hopeful this information can get out and our technologies can advance to where we can stabilize this planet and go forward and go out into space peacefully. And I think that if we did that as a civilization, we would find the universe would throw its arms open, and we'd be shocked at how quickly we'd be accepted into a sort of a new interplanetary culture. But, you know, the entry ticket to that is living at the what Michi Kaku called it, a level one civilization. And a level one civilization, if we're the whole civilization on a planet is peaceful and is no longer destroying its environment to subsist and exist. We're not there yet. We're a level zero civilization.
No, we're still ready to go out into space with as many weapons as we can.
Right. And, it's the stupidness, really. But at the same time, you know, our higher angels, let's say, if we could come together as a people and make that change happen, I think that we'd see that there would be an amazing level of contact that would begin.
Well, we are going to explore that possibility as soon as we come back. We're with Dr. Stephen Greer, and stick around. If you're just joining us, we're with Dr. Stephen Greer. He was just recently explaining the lack of benevolence that we seem to share, the lack of trust. And so we bring our slingshots and bows and arrows into outer space and risk a good relationship creation or at the very least credibility with anybody that might be obviously far more advanced than we people. Dr. Greer, with them, the aliens, wherever they may be from, as you're saying, they are obviously very well restrained. I don't know how I would be as an alien shooting by here in one of my incredibly fantastically powered craft if I were to notice what the hell is going on in Fukushima.
Right.
And the spewing. First of all, I was so angry at myself for not even knowing that the decision was already made by Japanese officials to use nuclear power and to build them on a volcanic ridge. Seems the height of stupidity, and I couldn't believe I didn't know that. So now we know where we're at with that disaster, and that it's actually, many say, in far worse shape now than the day it hit. March.
Well, actually, you know, let's not point the finger at the Japanese so much. The San Onofre power plant there north of San Diego near Camp Pendleton, a marine base on the coast of California, is built squarely on the San Andreas Fault. Are you kidding me with this stuff by the ocean? So the same thing could happen here very, very easily.
All right. So, but if I'm an alien seeing that and I have unbelievable technology to your tiny mind, I'm very tempted to do something about that, if not for the sake of these little Earthlings, then for the sake of this sector of the universe.
Well, I think the ETs are, by the way, I use the word ET just because I think of alien as very a xenophobic term.
Oh, okay.
But I think the ETs are more concerned with seeing if we arise to the occasion and fix these big problems ourselves. It's a little Star Trek-y, but it's sort of like the prime directive not to interfere too much. Now, with that said, there have been events where my understanding is that when we were getting close to a nuclear launch with the Soviet Union, there were some things that were done that were atomic weapons and nuclear systems were shut down or would be taken offline. And some of our witnesses were at Minot, North Dakota, when that happened in Malmstrom Air Force Base. And 16 intercontinental ballistic missiles were taken offline at the same time. And there was this huge UFO outside the silo and outside the underground command center. And we have the documents and the testimony for this, and it's on our website at SiriusDisclosure.com, S-I-R-I-U-S, Disclosure.com. Now, when you go there and see this testimony, remember that the men who were there at the time felt that basically it wasn't a hostile act. It was an act of the ET saying, look, please don't blow up this beautiful planet. But if you go to this level of launch that would destroy life on this planet, we can easily shut down that system. Now, this, however, set off alarm bells all the way through the Strategic Air Command and all of that, because here they're going with, you know, 16 to 20 intercontinental ballistic missiles, each of which had multiple nuclear hydrogen bombs on them, being completely taken offline. They weren't damaged, but it was complete. They were rendered unlaunchable. And so by the way, the same thing was happening in the Soviet Union. And Sam Donaldson did a piece for, I think it was Primetime Live, years ago, that talked about that. And you begin to look at this and you say, well, what's really going on? I think they're saying, look, you know, we will only intervene if it becomes so bad that you really are reaching the point of no return, and we haven't reached that. Now, I think that with the environment, I've found that with many of the sightings, if you analyze them, they are around atomic weapons facilities, space facilities, and the third category where you see a lot of UFO activity are around seismically unstable areas, volcanoes and fault lines. And so there is apparently some kind of monitoring that is an ongoing project of the ETs having to do around those parameters that we've been able to document. And it makes complete sense. One of an amazing bit of footage that we have in the film Sirius, which if people really want to see a summary of all the work I've done, we have a new documentary out called Sirius, S-I-R-I-U-S again, like the star system or like the radio network Sirius radio. And that film you can see online now at our site. You can see it video on demand or get the DVD. But that film, in it, it shows some footage of one of these things coming up out of and going around this volcano in Japan, ironically, years before Fukushima happened. And also out by the volcano outside Mexico City, the Popocatépetl, I believe it's called. They call it Popo, this huge 18,000-foot volcano. And I actually went there on an expedition where we'd set up our contact protocols. When we have a program for making contact where we utilize a certain set of protocols to try to vector in or guide these ET craft in. And we were there on the side of this volcano in Mexico, and this massive triangular ship comes right out from it. And there were others that were going into it and around it. And so obviously they had some concern or were doing some sort of monitoring around these large, unstable, what they call the Pacific Ring of Fire, which is the ring of fault lines and volcanoes that are up and down the Pacific, all on not only the U.S. side, but also the Asian and the Western Pacific side of that area of the Earth. And what I have found over the years is that it made complete sense. One of our disclosure project witnesses is a Colonel Diedrichsen, who was in charge of the Department of Energy, used to be called the Atomic Energy Commission, and he was in charge of all nuclear weapons storage facilities and research facilities for the Atomic Energy Commission. And he says on videotape, and we have this is a colonel, saying every single one of those facilities was overflown or observed by these ET craft when he was in charge of those programs in the 50s and 60s. And it's a really fascinating interview from an high-ranking, credible military witness. And people say, how many of these guys have you met with? I said, over 550. And we have over 110 of them on digital videotape. So I always laugh when people, well, where's the evidence for any of this? When I talk to someone who's in the lamestream, the mainstream media. And I'll say, are you kidding me with this? Can you read?
You're too busy. Yeah, you're too busy ignoring it.
Busy ignoring it and poo-pooing it, right?
Yeah, the thing that doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about I want to get into a little more of the human interest aspect of this. You came up with CE5. There were four CEs before that, Close Encounters.
Right.
So if you could run those down again for the five people or so that have not seen the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which is obviously when you actually meet the aliens, but just give us the 1 through 4 and tell us a little bit about the 5, which is solely your awareness and creation, as I understand it.
Right. Well, the first one is a close encounter. The first kind is when there's an object that's seen quite clearly, usually, at some distance. And then a close encounter of the second kind is when there's some kind of landing trace and physical evidence that's left. Now, people who are new to this should know that we have over 4,000 cases where these objects have landed and left physical evidence. One of the most famous ones was the Bentwaters Royal Air Force case back in the early 80s when a craft landed near Randlesham Forest and was documented. We have the Ministry of Defense documents for that, by the way, and the military personnel on our site at seriousdisclosure.com. Then a close encounter of the third kind is when there's someone actually sees and has an encounter with an actual extraterrestrial biological, or if it's not biological, it may be holographic or electronic. We can get into this in a moment. Sort of encounter. A close encounter of the fourth kind is when an individual has an encounter and then has an experience where they have been taken on a craft or maybe off planet and had that kind of experience. The close encounter of the fifth kind was a term that I coined back in 1990, and it is when a group of people decide to set up a diplomatic effort to overtly, not instead of, you know, sort of secret, instead of secretly in the military, but overtly and openly make peaceful contact through a set of protocols that I developed between 1977 and 1990. That deal with making contact so that we are inviting them to come and inviting them to make contact. And
now that includes meditation, is that right?
Well, it's interesting. The people say, well, what are the modalities or the techniques that are used? Well, we use laser signaling. We use electronic signaling. We have a lot of electronic equipment on site when we do this. And the most shocking and disturbing part of this to most people, although it was the thing that I found that the CIA director's wife was most interested in, ironically, who was the chief operating officer of the National Academy of Sciences, is the fact that interstellar civilizations that go faster than the speed of light, by definition, if they've gone from one star system or galaxy to this one, they have mastered an entirely new physics that I call trans-dimensional technologies. So if you're going beyond the speed of light, you're crossing into other quote-unquote dimensions. Those dimensions are intimately related to the energy field of coherent thought or visualized thought. It's sort of like a lucid dream, if you will. And so in a meditative state, you can train yourself to not only do, well, what the CIA has trained people to do, the remote viewing part of it, where you use consciousness to see a remote place in a meditative state, but you can turn it around to something more active where you can remotely see where the ET craft or planets are and then create a coherent stream as a group of thought where you connect to their electronic systems and show them where you are, where you literally vector them in like you would vector in a jet to JFK Airport in New York. And that's a technique that is at the center of the CE5, or Close Encounters of the Fifth Initiative. And right now we have literally thousands of teams all over the world. There's a, believe it or not, there's an iPhone app and an Android app that you can get to through our website called the Contact app that has the entire training program for doing that. And so thousands of people are now out there doing this, having amazing sightings and experiences, practicing this. And the reason it works, and this is the part that most people can't believe, is that ET civilizations, when they're communicating, or even when they're flying their craft, they can just think, they'll be touching a control panel and think to it, and the craft will go in that direction. So there's complete what was being developed at UNLV by Dr. Gene Radin, a psychic switch where the thought process itself can be very subtly picked up through electronics and with machinery, I'm talking now, the really advanced stuff. We're not talking, you know, stuff that we would have now too much on Earth. And those technologies are at the core of the communication systems of these interstellar civilizations, which is why so many people who've had contact describe, they'll see the craft there or the ET there, and they're getting a thought directly in their minds that they're hearing, and they're not hallucinating.
That would explain breaking through what people labor under as the speed of light and the speed of sound. This reminds me very much of the book, The Secret Life of Plants.
Exactly.
Where
exactly.
The communication is instant.
Well, or as Rupert Sheldrake, Dr. Sheldrake, who I know, and he and I have lectured at things together, where he talks about the morphogenic fields, where in the field of consciousness itself, that you have the ability to break out of time and space and the barrier of time and space. And what I've done is take that knowledge scientifically and turn it into an active sort of diplomatic protocol using thought and consciousness. And the reason I was... The way I stumbled across this is a very long story. We don't have time for it. But when I was 17 years old, I had a near-death experience. And then from that near-death experience, I went, oh, my God, there's something that's beyond the physical. And I began to learn meditation and suddenly found I could remote view and do a lot of have a lot of these experiences. So then I turned that into I remembered the contact experience I had, and I had a subsequent one, and I turned it into a protocol to make contact with these ET civilizations. I was an 18-year-old kid. I certainly didn't understand what I do now about the science of this. But I subsequently came to understand that these ET civilizations have, if you will, electronics that interface with very clear intent and thought when it's emerging out of this non-locality of consciousness, this sort of omnipresent field of consciousness, which is the secret life of plants and also Rupert Sheldrake's morphogenic fields. And this is at the core. You know, I do four or five things a year where I take people out under the stars and teach them all these techniques. And we don't have a schedule up for 2014 yet, but we just finished doing one up in Arizona last month. And it was just amazing because we're up there at 5,000 feet and in the mountains outside Tucson, and we're doing these protocols, and suddenly this object just materializes over the valley, floats up, takes a right-hand turn, another right-hand turn, and takes off. So, you know, we have so many photos and videos of this happening in the context of us practicing these protocols, and people are just sort of stunned that this is going on. Now, getting back to the first part of our discussion, the reason the CIA director and these other people asked me to come in and brief them, even in the UFO subculture, what I'm doing is highly controversial, which I will admit, it was because they knew we actually had made contact. Interestingly, one of the early events that happened was in Florida on the coast, not far from Pensacola. And we had 40 or 50 people there on a weekend sort of training expedition I was doing. And there were a couple Air Force people there. One was a colonel. And first one, then two, then three, then four ET craft materialized in the sky quite near us, which we have on videotape, but it's not very good because it was the old high 8 film, and we didn't have night vision scopes back then. But, this is 1992. But what's interesting is that made its way up through the chain of command all the way to the guy who had been head of Army Intelligence, who called me in for a meeting. So, and then that led to this other man finding out, who was good friends with the CIA director for President Clinton in 93. So the thing that was most interesting to the intelligence community, the high end of it, I mean the really high end, was the fact that there were humans able to do this, which breaks us out of the secrecy. Think about it. If humans can learn this, and it takes some discipline, I'll admit it, but if humans can learn this, then you can completely bypass the stranglehold that the governmental entities have had on the secrecy. And I actually had this guy who's a former head of Army Intelligence threaten me. He says, "What the hell do you think you're doing? You've discovered the Rosetta Stone of contact." And I said, "Yes, sir, we have, and we're going to do it. And what are you going to do about it?" I said, "You can kill me, but I don't believe in death, so that doesn't matter. I'm a doctor, so I'm not rich, but I'm wealthy enough. You can't buy me off." He tried to. I was offered $2 billion with a B in 1992 to stop what I was doing.
Back in 92, that was really worth something.
Yeah, $2 billion was some serious money. And, you know, the guy then, I said no, and he approached my wife, believe it or not. And then I said, "You can't fool me about what's real and what isn't. You know, whether it's real or Memorex, hello. I mean, I know, you know, we've had contact. We're not deceived by your little silly games of scaring people with all the made-up stuff and fake stuff like abductions and mutilations." I said, "I know who's doing that in the intelligence community." So what ended up happening from that is that he just kind of shook his head, and he turned to one of his assistants who had been an NSA, National Security Agency guy, and said, "Well, we know exactly who this son of a bitch is," like that. I said, "Yep, that's right." So, you know, there are people who really hate my guts. But the fact of the matter is that it was these contact events are what really captured the interest of these people in the government, believe it or not, more than even the technological stuff dealing with zero point and anti-gravity.
Well, in the very few minutes we have left, I have a few questions for you. In your documentary, there is a prominent amount of time spent with a 6-inch creature that is the Atacama skeleton. Fascinating little guy. And you had him tested. You had the DNA looked at. You were doing CAT scans. And in the movie, it is pretty clear that it is a deceased alien life form. Again, folks, 6 inches, 150 millimeters long. Later on, the story goes, after your movie came out, apparently there is genetic evidence showing that it was a human child skeleton with this incredibly distorted
brain. See, this is the whole spin that the media does on.
Sure, stuff. Yeah, and I want to get that open. I'm trying to give this to you on a platter.
No. I mean, here it is. I mean, the problem is that there's a guy who's not very well educated in science at the Huffington Post who started writing about this, and it had 4 or 5 million views on it. The geneticist at Dr. Nolan at Stanford University, it had the top team in the world run the genetics on it. To this day, neither he nor I know what this thing is. Does it have some genes that match to humans? Yes, because don't forget...
Don't we all?
Wait a minute. Gorillas have 98.4% identical genes to you and me.
Wow.
Even a fruit fly has a lot of genes that are the same. If you look at mice, they're 70% identical to you and me. If you look at a Neanderthal, which is a different species than humans, it's 99.5% identical genetics.
But it sounds like that.
Now at this point, he's finding that the best match he can do with a 50-time run through, with the best all the 2,500 databases of human genes in the world, is 91%. So this little creature is only 91% matching to humans. That is much more difference than us in a chimp or us in a Neanderthal or us in a gorilla. So now the other part of this is that the none of the genes for dwarfism are there that you would expect to see, because this is a 6 to 8 year old child that's only 6 inches tall. Now, how do we know that? The world's expert at Stanford, named Dr. Ralph Lockman, wrote a report and signed it and initialed every page, and it's on our website. Go read it. And he states that this is a 6 to 8 year old child that's only 6 inches tall. Now, as an emergency doctor, I have done emergency deliveries for premature babies. I have never kept anything alive that's only 6 inches, never mind to live to be 6 to 8 years of age. It only has 10 ribs instead of 12, which there are no genetic syndromes for that. In other words, there are still so many anomalies. Now, so when the geneticists put out the report that it has genes that match with humans, then the debunkers came in and said, see, it's just a deceased human child of some type. Well, it isn't. First of all, how many people in a remote, this was found in the Atacama Desert in Chile, how do you keep 100 or 200 years ago, which is when we think this creature lived, how do you keep a human child alive that's only 6 inches tall for 6 to 8 years of age so that its bones have developed to that point? Now, how do we know that? You look at what are called the epiphyseal plates or the growth plates that are in the long bones. All of the long bones, not just in the legs, but all of them show that this is a 6 to 8 year old child. So how do you square this circle? The fact of the matter is, to this date, as of today's interview, we have no idea what this creature is. The people who are out there saying they know what it is are liars, debunkers, or untutored, uneducated people in the science who don't know any science.
It is fascinating to me, though, that with that claim that they have decided it's pretty much just a child from a Chilean woman, that so many people would believe that based on looking at this thing. The camera work that's in your film highly, depicts this. It's impossible and inconceivable to think it's a human child.
Right. Well, I think the problem is that people don't like things not to be nailed down. And when the geneticist unfortunately worded his report that it has, he called it human because he's at Stanford. He's not going to call it an ET. Number one. Number two, I'm not calling it ET. Why? Because we don't have a genetic database of an ET race that matches this, because no one has a genetic database of ETs. It's only in the last decade that we've had a genetic database of humans, all right? So we have to be conservative. And so he's being ultra-conservative because he's a senior professor that has 30 or 40 postdoctoral PhDs that work under him in his lab. He's the Harris Chair at Stanford, very prestigious.
He's protecting himself.
No, he protects himself, but he's just being scientific by saying we have to consider this human until proven otherwise.
Right.
So did Dr. Lockman. But stepping out of the politics of that for a minute, let's just analyze this. Go show me a human child that's 6 inches high, that lives to be 6 to 8 years of age, and how do you keep it alive? In our most advanced intensive care units for children today, we couldn't do that. How do you do it 100 to 200 years ago in a primitive area of Chile?
Yeah, it's inconceivable.
It is
a linchpin of your film, and once again, I will plug that film. The movie is called Sirius. You can find out all about this research and wonderful work that Dr. Greer and his team are doing at SiriusDisclosure.com. I do have one more question. Will you come on in the new year?
Yeah, let's do it again. It'd be great.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Conspiracy Queries with Alan Park. Please offer comments or complaints by emailing conspiracyqueries@gmail.com or on Twitter @con_queries or at our website, conspiracyqueries.com. Thanks for listening.